This podcast is part of the Acast Creator Network.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to The Stand with Eamon Dunphy. Now, last July, the House of Representatives in the United States, which is controlled by the Democrats, announced the formation of a committee which would investigate what happened in what is now widely agreed was an insurrection on January the 6th, 2021. It was the day when Joe Biden's victory was to be certified, and it was the day that a mob, thought at the time to be almost a spontaneous mob, urged on by Donald Trump, attacked the Capitol and chanted that Mike Pence, the vice president, should be hung. Pence, constitutionally, is the person who oversees the certification and the implementation of the will of the people of the United States, which was that Joe Biden, through the Electoral College, was the new president of the United States. And for 12 months, it's ambled on without really convincing anyone or changing minds. However, in the last fortnight, they have held televised hearings, which are a mixture of video footage of testimony given to them by, for example, the president's daughter and others who agreed to testify, a mixture of that and live testimony from people who were involved at the time and were very often pressurized. We're joined now from Washington by Niall Stanage, associate editor of The Hill, a very good nonpartisan newspaper in Washington. Niall is associate editor and White House columnist for The Hill. Niall, my attempt there to characterize this committee and its work is basically my take on it. How accurate is it?
I mean, I think that is broadly accurate. I think that the question has always been twofold. One is whether it can change people's minds, which a lot of people have been skeptical about. But the second thing is whether it can uncover new and telling information, which I think it has been much more effective in that regard. It has really presented a very compelling case against former President Trump and his allies, and I think has really underlined to those who have watched it that how much of this whole effort was both organized and a knowing fraud. In other words, yes, there has been enormous information provided about people telling, emphasizing, and proving to Trump that his claims of election fraud on a wide scale were simply not true, and him and other people like Rudy Giuliani going ahead with their plans and efforts regardless.
Yes, and we have evidence now that Trump repeatedly told those involved with him in this endeavor, and in particular Mike Pence, who he met repeatedly and urged him not to certify the Electoral College votes. He said to Pence and to others, Pence has to do is reject them, the Electoral College, get the votes sent back to the states on a technicality, and leave the rest, and I'm quoting him here, leave the rest to me and our congressional friends. And the other mantra was, we've got to get to the courts. So he was trying to cause chaos, confusion, stop the process on January the 6th of certification, and then leave the rest to Republican congressmen and women, and of course, to the courts. And that is rather ominous in a big way, because we know the Supreme Court, one of his greatest achievements, if not his greatest achievement, is to get three of his nominees onto the Supreme Court, where now what we might call conservatives have a 6-3 majority.
Yes, I mean, certainly to put all this in context, had Trump's plan proceeded, there is no real way that a constitutional crisis could have been averted. For people who haven't been following this step by step or haven't been listening to us as we have recounted all this, the plan really was that what is actually provided for in law is the vice president goes to Congress and counts the electoral votes as they come in from the states. What Trump wanted Pence to do was refuse to count those votes, to move that process back to perhaps Republican-led legislatures,
yes,
who would then appoint their own slate of electors to overturn the popular vote. It is almost unimaginable what would have happened had that proceeded. I mean, it would have, I assume, led to riots in the streets beyond what happened on January the 6th. Now, Pence, to his credit, did not do that, and he refused to do that at some significant physical danger to himself. As for the courts element of this, there was a very controversial conservative lawyer by the name of John Eastman, who was proposing all sorts of labyrinthine plots and hopes of getting Trump in for a second term. But, you know, one of the interesting things that has come out in the hearing was the degree of pushback Eastman received even from, fairly centrist or conservative figures. For example, an aide to Pence had told Eastman that even with the current makeup of the Supreme Court, if they had pursued Eastman's plans, they would have lost 9-0. So, you know, that gives some, I think, suggestion of how flimsy these plans were. But also, you know, as things go forward, obviously it is an ominous sign for the future that those plans were present and being worked on and were only resisted because a few people stood up against them.
Yes, and central to it was the Department of Justice. Mm. And they were the people that Trump focused in on. They were the key. And the Attorney General of the time, William Barr, Bill Barr, he was someone who had obliged Trump to some degree, to some considerable degree, during the active presidency. But when he saw what was being asked of the Department of Justice and of him, at a certain point he said, enough is enough. And he gave evidence, and it was powerful evidence this week and last week, in which he called what Trump was claiming as bullshit.
That's right.
A quote. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And a quote, he said that on a number of occasions. Bill Barr had been a sort of hate figure for liberals. I mean, he is a very conservative person in his ideological outlook, and in fact had incurred the wrath of liberals because at the time that the Mueller report into allegations of Russian collusion came out, Bill Barr was seen as pivotal in pushing back against the Mueller report and in dulling its impact. Now he's in a very different role, pushing back on these claims of election fraud, being absolutely dismissive of them as bullshit, as you say. And, you know, interestingly, and I think you may have mentioned this in your introduction, Ivanka Trump, there's a video clip of her shown at the very first of these public hearings, in which she acknowledged that she accepted Barr's assessment that there had been no large-scale fraud in the election and that she took him at his word in that respect. That was a very powerful piece of testimony because of who it was coming from, pushing back against the fictions propagated by her father.
Yes. Now, one of the important, perhaps even vital, facts of recent times has been the degree to which Trump's fiction about a stolen election has been accepted as the truth by Republican voters. It is extraordinary, and you might give us the figures, because they are extraordinary. This is the figure: how many registered Republicans believe that Joe Biden is the legitimate president of the United States. Guessing off the top of my head from the last conversation we had on this, about 71% of Republicans do think that the election was stolen.
Yes, it is in that ballpark. Most polls show that figure among Republican voters as between 70 and 80%. So you're quite right in your assessment. There has, incidentally, been another development in that respect just within the past week, which I can't imagine has got much publicity in Ireland, which was that a convention of the Texas Republican Party approved a measure at its convention declaring that President Joe Biden, and this is a quote, was not legitimately elected. Yes. The Republican Party, in obviously one of the biggest states in the Union, asserting that, something which is not true, obviously. So that shows, I think, the extent to which that lie has percolated through American political life, particularly on the right. It goes to a point that we have also mentioned before, Eamon, about how there's a sort of conservative media and political ecosystem that is kind of self-contained in ways, and which facts, hostile facts in particular, simply don't penetrate. And that's one of the reasons, I think, why you see such high numbers of Republicans continuing to insist that the election was in some fashion stolen.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Now, the televised hearings have allowed us to see some of the testimony given in private by Bill Barr, for example, former Attorney General, but it has also offered us live testimony from people who were involved in this drama. And one of the most memorable moments in this whole affair lasted an hour and 13 minutes. And the subject of it was the Secretary of State for Georgia, Brad Raffensperger. He received a call from then President Trump in late December. And Trump wanted him to find 11,700 votes. And the call was recorded and televised. Raffensperger, a Republican, had voted for Donald Trump, but he steadfastly refused to oblige the president. This was riveting at the time. It was desperately, desperately close. Well, it was a law-breaking, I suppose. But Raffensperger stood his ground, and Rusty Bowers, a man called Rusty Bowers, who was a speaker in the House of Representatives in Arizona, is another figure. These people appeared, but Raffensperger and Gabriel Sterling, who was his right-hand man, they were very interesting about the pressures they felt and their determination to follow the Constitution.
Yes, they were. And I think that by any objective measure, they were very impressive. The phone call to Brad Raffensperger that emerged, you know, a while after it was made, was really shocking, even by the standards of the Trump presidency. This request or demand to find, and that was the words Trump used, to find the exact number of votes to overturn Biden's victory in the state of Georgia, is sort of blustery, kind of gang boss kind of yes. behavior. I mean, that was the overall demeanor or the overall approach. It's actually, in a way, of a piece of the thing that you quoted earlier on in this podcast, Eamon, about the request that the Department of Justice should just say the election was corrupt and leave the rest, as yes. Trump put it, to me and the Republican congressman. Man, I mean, these are sort of a brutal and authoritarian way of trying to conduct yourself and trying to conduct the aftermath of an American election. We should note, Eamon, that although it's unclear what's going to happen at the federal level, from Washington in the Department of Justice, there is an investigation in Georgia, a criminal investigation into Trump's efforts to try to overturn the result in that state. Separate from the testimony we're talking about, Brad Raffensperger has testified in secret to the grand jury in that Georgia case, where there is still obviously a chance that actual criminal charges would be pursued. But as you say, it's not just Raffensperger, Rusty Bowers, the Arizona State House Speaker, a very personally conservative person, again, was yes. Making the point about all sorts of cockamamie schemes to try to overturn the election result in his state, which he also, to his credit, pushed back against.
And there was a development yesterday where a man called Jeffrey Clark, who was working in the Department of Justice in its environmental department, but a House Republican representative had discovered Mr. Clark, who was prepared, it seems, to replace Bill Barr and to replace the acting attorney generals at the time. Now, the acting attorney general was a man called Jeffrey Rosen, and his acting deputy was a man called Richard Donahue. Mm. They gave very compelling testimony last night. But Clark had offered to take the job, which he was not qualified to do, and Trump was trying to give it to him. Yesterday, the FBI raided his house and took away electronic devices, documents, and all that. It appears that Clark may have breached the law and may have been involved in a conspiracy with a Republican senator and the president.
Republican congressman, but yes.
Congressman. Yeah.
That's right. I mean, that he is clearly in some degree of legal jeopardy. Otherwise, the FBI wouldn't be raiding his house. I mean, they generally only do that if you're in some considerable hot water. But the story with Jeffrey Clark is that he was clearly allied with Trump's aims. He had suggested this idea, which was that the Department of Justice would write to Georgia and some of the contested states, asserting that it had essentially, I'm summarizing here, found evidence of shady behavior in voting, and that therefore the process of confirming the election results should sort of be frozen or paused. That would have required the DOJ to lie. They had not, in fact, discovered yes. that level of malfeasance in the elections. And the suggestion that they should write such a letter was naturally received with horror, really, by people like Jeff Rosen, who by that stage had replaced Bill Barr. Rosen was the acting Attorney General, and Richard Donahue, whom you mentioned. The point is that Trump, annoyed with the existing official's refusal to do his bidding, was considering replacing Rosen with Clark, as you said, and apparently was only dissuaded from that maneuver whenever the senior leadership of the Department of Justice, including Rosen, and yes. obviously Rosen would be replaced, but Donahue, said they would resign immediately if that happened, and Trump uncharacteristically backed off.
And they also said there would be mass resignations
Correct.
From the Department of Justice, and that would have amounted to hundreds of people. That was the moment, perhaps, that saved the Republic. Mm. I mean, the fact of the matter here, I saw Bob Woodward and Carol Bernstein and John Dean on television for the last two nights. They all think this is worse than Watergate. And I personally think it probably is as well. John Dean was counsel to Richard Nixon in the White House, and Woodward and Bernstein, of course, were the journalists who received information to show that the president had broken the law. But they think that this was worse, more blatant, and more troubling because so many mainstream players, that is, elected politicians and others, were up for doing it. In other words, America's democracy would have been bust.
Yes, and it would have attacked the fundamentals of American democracy in an even more corrosive way, I think, than Watergate did. I mean,
yes.
to summarize, particularly for younger listeners, in Watergate, it was assumed, if not proven, that Richard Nixon, the sitting president, was involved or complicit in a break-in at the Democratic
yes.
Party's headquarters in the Watergate building. Now, I mean, that's obviously a horrendous thing for any president to be complicit in. But in the case of Trump and the 2020 election on January the 6th, what you were talking about really was something that would have overturned a legitimate election and incinerated the tradition of a peaceful transfer of
yes.
power. That, I mean, it's hard to know how democracy recovers from that, had it been successful. And as you just pointed out, there was a fairly thin line between its potential success and its actual failure. And therein lies one of the big dangers.
Yeah, the thin line was has a name, Mike Pence.
Mm.
And of course, these people from the Department of Justice, all of whom one assumes were Republicans. That's why it was a Republican administration.
Mm.
And this is perhaps where this committee and these public hearings illustrate in a way that documents can't. The people involved, their obvious integrity, the pressures they were placed under, and all of them are not Democrats. All of them are Republicans.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that is a very good point as far as the witnesses are concerned. We were talking at the start about the idea that this
yeah.
committee was initially characterized as a partisan endeavor. It only has two Republicans alongside seven Democrats, and those two Republicans, Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, are anti-Trump Republicans. Most of the Republican Party boycotted this committee's work. Now, the idea that it was that the Republicans were then going to delegitimize the committee seemed at one point plausible. It seems less plausible, in my opinion,
yes.
now because of how much the public hearings have leaned upon testimony from Republicans and people who are clearly, whatever their party affiliation, sort of small c conservative in their personal dispositions. I mean, you were watching the Department of Justice related hearing on Thursday, Eamon. None of those guys are exactly going to, you know, flock to the barricades with AOC or Bernie Sanders. They are are clearly very establishment type figures, not sort of firebrand liberals by any stretch of the imagination. So that's an interesting point.
Yes, and that's where the figure I referred to earlier of 71% of Republicans or thereabouts believing that the election was stolen. Mm. The election clearly wasn't stolen. Mm. And here are Republicans, staunch Republicans, people who voted for Donald Trump, but whose first obligation was to their duty. In the case of Brad Raffensperger, he was Secretary of State for Georgia. And these people are believers in the Constitution and in the American system.
Yes.
But the question is now, I understand, Niall, there has been some recriminations in the light of the success of these their televised hearings from Republicans in the House, particularly aimed at McCarthy, our old friend Kevin, for not allowing people to go on the committee and leaving only two. The committee is nine strong, I think.
Seven, that's correct.
Seven Democrats, only two Republicans. They should have put more Republicans on the committee, they think now.
Yes, that's right. And Trump himself has come to that view. So he'll be displeased with my Kevin, as he calls him again now, because the idea was to paint to boycott the committee and therefore paint it as illegitimate. The difficulty that has now been exposed with that is during these public hearings, there is an uninterrupted narrative from the seven Democrats and the two anti-Trump Republicans who I mentioned, that has no dissenting voice in the hearing room at all.
Yes.
Now, had McCarthy been a bit more flexible and said, okay, I won't put there were two particularly extremely staunch pro-Trump Republicans against whom Pelosi objected. Had McCarthy said, okay, we'll switch it to people who are more pro-Trump but a bit more temperate, then that would probably have been a strategically better move on the Republican side.
Yeah, so we don't know until there's some polling. Do we know what kind of audiences? And we should also say that Fox News refuses to show these hearings and is kind of offering made-up commentary or idiotic commentary on the side. Nevertheless, Fox News is the leading cable channel watched. Is there a possibility that this will cut through and American people will say, we came close there to losing our democracy?
There's not an enormous sign of the polling numbers changing. Fox News, for example, didn't show the first hearing, which was the big primetime one. Now, 20 million people approximately watched that, which is a big audience by anybody's standards. Fox, in a somewhat unusual example of being perhaps sensitive or receptive to criticism, has shown some of the later daytime hearings and has seen its audience fall as soon as those hearings began, which I mentioned to just illustrate the point that of how sort of symbiotic the relationship is between Fox and its audience. It's an audience that doesn't really want to see that stuff. As for it breaking through, there was a poll out just this past weekend that suggested that the share of the American people who believe that Trump should be criminally prosecuted has ticked up modestly. Now, it's at 58% in this latest poll from ABC News. It was at 52% before the hearings began. That is, a measurable change, but a fairly modest one. I do think this is perhaps a separate issue. I do think it has perhaps damaged Trump in the race for the 2024 Republican nomination in the sense of would Republicans think, or would some Republicans think, we really just don't want all this drama. Can we get some other conservative with less baggage attached? Mm-hmm. But, you know, if your question is there going to be a sea change after these hearings where the American people will come to a consensus? No, I don't think there is, because I think the partisanship and polarization is much too deeply entrenched.
Yes, and just a final question, Niall, about something that happened, unrelated, that happened yesterday. The Supreme Court voted against New York, the state of New York, which has a gun law test that you have to pass before you can buy a gun. It's not a very stringent test, I don't think, but maybe you'll explain exactly what the ruling was. There's one other thing I should ask you, and it's about the behavior of Clarence Thomas's wife. Clarence Thomas is a Supreme Court judge, controversially appointed a long time ago, but nevertheless, his wife was very active and is very active in the QAnon conspiracy theory. And she wrote a letter, didn't she, about this whole business we've been discussing for 25 minutes. And she really is on the side of the cowboys.
Ginny Thomas is Clarence Thomas's wife. She has been a conservative activist for a very, very long time. The QAnon thing, I think she would object to, but she's certainly identified with the wilder or more extreme fringes of the right. And she did write to pivotal figures in the individual states or the contested states, urging them, in essence, to support these efforts to push back against Biden's victory and to deliver the election to Trump. The Supreme Court matter about guns and New York, a separate matter, as you say, is that the Supreme Court has struck down a restriction that New York had or has, which required anyone who wants to carry a concealed handgun outside their own home to show proper cause in order to be licensed for that purpose. Yeah. New York had said that you can't just say, well, it's generally for my own safety. You have to show a special reason why you should have that ability. The Supreme Court, by a 6-3 margin, along what we might call party lines, six conservative justices, struck down that restriction, arguing that it infringed upon the Second Amendment's guarantee of the right to bear arms. Very controversial decision, coming on the same day as the US Senate passed gun control legislation, which, although fairly modest, was also the most significant in many, many years.
And we must also record that this Supreme Court is very active in the right to life, or Roe v. Wade. The 1973 ruling on abortion is now being revisited, and this Supreme Court is going to move things in a very dramatic way from a European perspective anyway. So it is not, it's an activist Supreme Court. And it's fair to just end our conversation now with the thought that's often in my mind, that the greatest service Donald Trump did for certain causes was the appointment of three Supreme Court justices, which is an enormous power. And that will possibly be his legacy, hopefully, because the legacy could get worse in the next few years.
It is enormous power because, of course, the Supreme Court is lifetime appointments, and it decides many of the most significant and divisive issues in American life. So in that sense, via those three Supreme Court justices who are comparatively young by the standards of the High Court, Donald Trump will have clearly an influence on American life for several decades to come.
Comforting thought. And now, just as we're talking about the American Supreme Court, we have breaking news coming in, Niall, that a monumental decision has just been handed down. The Supreme Court has overruled Roe v. Wade, eliminating the constitutional right to abortion, which has stood for almost 50 years, 49 years, in fact, in a decision that will transform American life, reshape the nation's politics, and will lead to all but total bans on the procedure in about half the states in the United States. This is an extraordinary decision with a massive historical resonance.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, a monumental decision, really. The biggest intervention by the Supreme Court in American life that I can remember. I mean, we've seen big rulings before, you know, in comparatively recent years about things like same-sex marriage. But this is massive. An extremely rare and perhaps unique event of the court at one point 49 years ago enshrining a right and then taking it away. There are about 13 states that have so-called trigger laws, which means that abortion in those states will become illegal immediately or almost immediately. In fact, as I speak with you, just within a very short time of the ruling, Missouri, the state of Missouri, has already triggered that law, apparently rendering abortion illegal there. And we'll see that cascade across the nation. You're quite right to point out that around half the states, including the 13 that I just cited, have very immediate restrictions on abortion or will be likely to outlaw it. In some cases, and this is a bit of a historical curiosity, really, in some of those cases, there were abortion bans in some states that were rendered unconstitutional by the original Roe versus Wade 1973 decision, but the ban has never been taken off the books. Therefore, yes. Now the Supreme Court has struck down Roe v. Wade, that ban would presumably become germane and become the guiding law.
Yes, and I'm just noticing now, coming in off the wires, a statement from the governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, who is congratulating the Supreme Court for a decision he believes that is in line with the rights and feelings of the American people. And there will be lots of people, lots of politicians, and abortion is deeply political everywhere. But in the United States, it's 1973, the original decision. It was regarded as a great liberation for women by people who weren't of a conservative persuasion. But as we were just talking about a few moments ago, the Supreme Court has ruled on guns. And on this much more emotive subject on consecutive days, which is really a striking testimony to the power of the president to appoint people to this powerful court.
It is unquestionably so. I mean, guns and abortion, obviously two of the most divisive issues in American life. Abortion particularly, I mean, not to belittle the gun ruling, which was significant in itself, but this abortion ruling, absolutely massive. And just a point about Governor Abbott's comment that you cited.
Yes.
It is true that when people are asked, you know, whether they agree with the right to abortion or whatever, an enormous amount depends upon how you phrase that question and what options you give people to answer. And there hasn't been the movement toward the liberal side that we've seen in things like same-sex marriage, for example, which have become sort of settled issues. Abortion is still very divisive.
Yes.
Having said that, polling which specifically asks, should Roe v. Wade be upheld or overturned, almost always shows a significant majority in favor of upholding Roe versus Wade. That has now been gone against by the Supreme Court, and we'll have to see what the political ramifications of that are, given that there was, as I say, a majority in favor of the compromise in some ways of Roe v. Wade as a decision.
Yes, now a few minutes ago, we spent a lot of time talking about the hearings on the January 6th matter, the implications for Donald Trump, possible crimes that may have been committed. This ruling will take the hearings off the front page, I imagine, and the weekend news programs and newspapers will deal with this. We're both journalists. This is the story, and the hearings and the Donald will take second place to this, but it does not in any way give people comfort about the power conferred on American president and the way that Donald Trump used that power to appoint people to the Supreme Court. And I know, for example, and we've spoken on this podcast before, Niall, that Mitch McConnell, who was the Senate majority leader during the Trump presidency, despises Trump. But this packing of the courts, if you like, and he appointed people all the way down the line, conservative people, Mitch McConnell saw and regarded as powerful and very, very important and very profound.
Yes, no question. I mean, Mitch McConnell, I think, is emblematic of a Republican tendency during the Trump years to hold your nose and vote for Trump or hold your nose and back Trump. And one of the chief reasons for that among people who are, you know, genuinely conservative but who disliked Trump was the power of the judiciary and the power of the American presidency to shape that judiciary. That power, of course, extends to much lower courts than the Supreme Court. It extends throughout the federal system. But it is most visible and most dramatic at the Supreme Court. We should also note, Eamon, that in the actual judgment that has come out, as I'm speaking to you today on Friday, does include a, for liberals, extremely ominous statement by Justice Clarence Thomas, who we mentioned earlier on in this podcast, where he talks about other previous or subsequent rulings dealing with various privacy rights, including same-sex marriage and contraception, suggesting that those could be, as he sees it, corrected in the same way as Roe v. Wade. That has caused great alarm in liberal circles, and that is a position that is, I think, could fairly be described as radical, you know, by anyone's standards.
Yes, just to underline the fact that the polarization of the United States on so many issues is only hardened by this decision, which will surely, and I wonder if you'd have a view on this. I know it's a bit early to be forming views on something we've just learned about. This could help Democrats. It could, if you like, galvanize their base, particularly with the midterms in mind next November, but also in terms of the presidency, for reminding them how potent the presidency can be.
Yes, it certainly could. And to that very point, Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, came out and gave a brief news conference very soon after the ruling from the Supreme Court was announced. She made the case that Republicans in Congress are intent now on a nationwide ban on abortion. She referred to that as them plotting for that end, which obviously isn't a word they would use. But the point is, Pelosi clearly sees a electoral imperative now to try to get liberals and the Democratic base, as you put it, galvanized to prevent such a nationwide ban taking place. In the absence of Roe v. Wade, there is nothing to prevent such a ban being enacted if it is passed by Congress, and of course subsequently signed, as it might be as early as 2024, early 2025, by a Republican president. A Democratic president wouldn't sign it, but and would have the power to veto it, but it becomes a live possibility once again.
Yes, and the bad news, if you like, for those who are in favor of abortion rights is that they have an ally who's just scrolling across my screen here. Boris Johnson has announced that the American Supreme Court has made a very big mistake. As if he didn't have enough troubles. This is a most profound and troubling ruling, not to make light of it at all.
Sure.
But we're very grateful to you, Niall, for bringing that news to us, and we'll talk to you soon. As always, we're grateful to Niall Standish, Associate Editor of The Hill. We're grateful to him and to all of you for listening. That's all we have time for now. We'll talk to you soon.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.